look for a passage where I can read about Nadab and Abihu, where would I look? Leviticus 10, that's right. All right, Peggy, if I want to read about King Saul and the blunders that he made and the disrespect he had for God's authority, where would I turn?
You should ask
him that. Okay. Help her out, Dick. Where I read about King Saul, and he was told to utterly destroy the Amalekites, and he did not.
Leviticus?
No, that's the one he had. Chris? 1 Samuel, chapter 15. Very good. There's a passage that tells me, David, there's a passage that tells me, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. Where? All right, to do anything in His name means what? By His authority. That's right. If I wanted to read about Cain and Abel, let's see, Carolyn, where would I read? Cain and Abel.
Oh, Cain and Abel.
Genesis 4, and I come to the New Testament, I learn of the faith of Abel, Hebrews 11. That's right. Verse 4. That tells me that Abel believed what God said and he did what God said. Betty Jo, there's a passage that tells me, why call ye me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say?
Luke.
All right, it's the one in Luke. 6:46. Very good. There's a passage, Peggy Sue, well, the other one, that says, whosoever goeth onward and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ, hath not God. In other words, we can't go beyond what we read.
2 John 9,
that's right. Katie, there's a passage that tells me that the Scriptures are sufficient to make me everything God wants me to be. They're inspired of God, they're profitable for a host of things. They're profitable. All right, 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17, but that's very, very good. Sarah, there's a passage that talks about the wide gate and the narrow gate. One leads to eternal life, one leads to eternal damnation. Where is that passage? Very good, very good. Emily, there's a passage that discusses the transfiguration of the Lord, where He went upon the mount with Peter and John, and there appeared unto him Moses and Elijah. And he was transfigured, or seen in brightness, as it were, before Peter, James, and John. Where do I read that? Somebody help her out. Jonathan?
17:1-5.
And Randy, what was the purpose of Elijah and John? Elijah and Moses appearing there with Jesus before James and John and Peter.
To show the apostles that Jesus has preeminence over the law and the prophets.
All right, that's very good. There's a passage that says, all authority hath been given unto me in heaven and on earth. Reba. Bruce. All authority hath been given unto me. All right, we got Matthew 28:18. All authority hath been given unto me in heaven and on earth. James, if all authority is given unto Christ, what authority is left for any man?
None.
All authority belongs to Him. There is a passage that tells us that there are some things that you just don't know the answer to. That there are some things that belong to God, but the things that are revealed belong to man. Where would I read that? Deuteronomy 29:29. That's right. There is a passage that tells us that if any have widows, let them relieve them, that the church be not charged, that it may relieve them that are widows indeed. Where is that? 1 Timothy 5:16, isn't it? Check that for me. I believe it's 16. I may be wrong. I may be wrong. All right, there are some passages that tell me that we're not under the Old Testament authority. Jonathan, give me one.
You
can give me a book.
Romans.
In fact, you can give me two more books now that you've started down that trail.
Galatians.
Yes, and?
Hebrews.
All right, Romans, Galatians, and Hebrews. All three of those books help us to understand what our relationship to the law is and isn't. Just to illustrate the point, in Romans the 7th chapter, the writer says in about verse 4, you are dead to the law. That's pretty specific, so we can understand our relationship. Now, in our study tonight, there are a couple of things that I want to do with lesson number 10 as we conclude some of those things, and then I want to go on to lesson number 11 and discuss the autonomy of the local church. So get out your lessons number 10, and we want to finish a thing or two, and then we'll proceed just a little farther. First Timothy 5:16. All right, good, good. It's good to know that I'm right every once in a while. All right. This is the chart that we left off on, and then I want to go on and talk about some other things as we look at the question period. We can make this come alive here. I may have to ask for some help from Richard. I had that on a while ago. And now it's off. Technology is a wonderful thing when it works. In your lesson sheets, you'll find, I forget what page it's on, but if you just listen carefully, it's on page number 66. Number 66, if you'll look at that. And Richard, appreciate what you can do to get that thing running.
Don't push the button.
Well, I had it blanked off and then it don't work. The Bible teaches that in 1 Corinthians, or 2 Corinthians it is, chapter 8, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, where we read of churches sending to one church. The churches were the churches of Macedonia, Galatia, and Achaia. We read the instructions given to the church at Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 and 2. We're familiar with that. But Paul readdresses the subject of the collection for the needy saints in Jerusalem in chapters 8 and 9 of the 2 Corinthian letter. And one of the things that we were talking about as we ran out of time last Wednesday evening was the text beginning at verse 12, 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 12. He says, "For if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according as a man hath, not according as he hath not. For I say not this, that others may be eased and ye distressed, but by equality, your abundance being a supply at this present time for their want, that their abundance also may become a supply for your want, that there may be equality. As it is written, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack." In these verses, we see why one church sent either to another church or to other churches. And what was the reason? Why did they do that?
For equality.
Let's elaborate on that just a little bit. In 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter, where this matter is first introduced, beginning at verse 1, the apostle said, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, let each one of you lay by him in store as God may prosper him, that there be no collections made when I come." And he said, "Whensoever I come," let's read it, "whensoever I come or arrive, whomsoever ye shall approve, them will I send with letters to carry your bounty unto Jerusalem." That's 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1, 2, and 3. You'll notice in the first verse, "Now concerning the collection," who was it for? For the saints. Specifically in verse 3, who was it for? Saints at Jerusalem. That's good. Now as Paul revisits this in the 2 Corinthian letter, in chapters 8 and 9, He talks about the churches of Macedonia, beginning at verse 1 of chapter 8. He speaks concerning the good that the churches, plural, of Macedonia have accomplished in sending their contribution to the needy saints in Jerusalem. Now, in verse 14, he tells us why they did that. It says that there might be equality. Read from the beginning of the verse, "But by equality, your abundance, being a supply at this present time for their want, that their abundance also may become a supply for your want, that there may be equality." Now, the question that we want to ask is, equality in reference to what? These churches, Paul says, they need to be equal. But equal in respect to what that's identified in the text? Roy? All right, not being destitute. Those of the churches of Galatia, Macedonia, and Achaia were called upon to send a collection to the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. What does that indicate about the churches of Galatia, Macedonia, and Achaia? David, you have a question. I saw your hand a moment ago. All right, they had abundance. But the saints in Jerusalem, there were some in that church whose needs exceeded the ability of the church in Jerusalem to supply. These other churches then were sending to the church at Jerusalem so that the needs of these saints could be supplied. Now on the chart, you'll notice that there was never a promoted need, that is, for projects larger than the responsibilities of the local church. If the local church here decided that we want to do some big project, but you see we don't have the money to do it, and we begin to solicit funds from other churches so that we can do that big project, then we'd have to ask, well, by what authority do we do that? You see, what happened among the brethren in Jerusalem was not some big project they just wanted to take on. They had members who did not have the necessities of life. Then it became the responsibility of other churches to supply the needs of those in Jerusalem. Now that becomes an important principle for us to understand because we don't see any kind of middleman in that kind of arrangement. Another thing that we want to notice in reference to that is that the need was temporary. The need among the saints in Jerusalem would not last forever. There would be a time when those who were destitute would eventually have the necessities of life. We see that principle taught in Acts the 11th chapter in verses 27 through 30, where Agabus came down from Jerusalem and prophesied concerning a famine that put all of Judea at risk. And so those in Antioch sent to the brethren that dwelt in Judea. Here was a circumstance that was a temporary circumstance that placed brethren in jeopardy for the necessities of life. Now, what we see in these examples, it constitutes a pattern. Why was their money, or its equivalent, sent from one church to another church? What becomes the common thread in all of these examples? A need, necessities of life. It wasn't to promote some kind of project that somebody just simply wanted to do. It was that there may be equality. Equality in respect of need. And so we see that in every instance, there was some kind of emergency circumstance that existed that was beyond the ability of that local church to supply. Now what we want to notice in that is that precludes some kind of a centralized oversight under either some board of directors or some local eldership where funds are centralized and then dispersed or distributed to other churches. We don't find that middleman arrangement in all of the New Testament. One other thing that we wanted to notice as we are looking in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, you'll notice beginning at verse 19, he said, "And not only so, but who was also appointed by the churches to travel with us in this matter of this grace, or in the matter of this grace, which is ministered by us to the glory of the Lord and to show our readiness, avoiding this, that any man should blame us in the matter of this bounty, which is ministered by us. For we take thought for things honorable, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. Now here we have a number of churches, Galatia, Macedonia, and Achaia, plurality of churches in each province. But yet we find that all of these churches were instructed by the apostle to take up a collection, that whomsoever you may select, I may take them with me. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And this text tells us that they would be messengers, as it were, to carry these funds of these sending churches. Paul said that there is a reason. He said, we don't want anybody, verse 20, to blame us in the matter of this bounty which is ministered by us. For we take thought for things honorable, not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. What's Paul suggesting? They're called messengers, verse 23, of the churches. What is Paul saying about taking these who were representatives of the sending churches with him to minister the funds that were collected by these churches? David? All right, Randy?
He was concerned about the way it looked.
The way it looked is important, isn't it? Paul said, I want to take, want to do things that will appear to be honorable in the sight of all men. He took thought of that. Sometimes we don't take thought that things appear to be honorable, even though they might be. We don't take safeguards to make sure that others can see that those things are maintained honorably. And Paul did in this passage. Again, what we want to see is that each church selected its own messengers. They didn't depend upon some kind of quote-unquote sponsoring church or sponsoring eldership to administer the responsibilities of that local church. They did that themselves. Now, a third thing or fourth thing that we want to see on this chart is that those who were to receive these funds are called what? Saints. Now, in our previous studies of 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, we wanted to make this observation. In 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter, that collection, as it was instructed, was to be for the poor saints in Jerusalem. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, as it is once again addressed, Paul again says, "Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God which hath been given in the churches of Macedonia, how that in much proof of affliction their abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality." Dropping down into the text as it continues into the 9th chapter. "For as touching the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write unto you. For I know your readiness, of which I glory on your behalf to them of Macedonia, that Achaia hath been prepared for a year past, and your zeal has stirred up very many of them." Let's pause in the reading. One of the things that we want to observe is that Paul wrote the 1 Corinthian letter from what city? Ephesus, Jonathan, that's right. He wrote the 1 Corinthian letter from Ephesus, all the way across the Aegean Sea. We notice that he continues to travel. He travels up north to a place called Troas. And from Troas, he sees a man in a vision from Macedonia saying, "Come over into Macedonia and help us." Paul came over into Macedonia. And during that time, he wrote the 2 Corinthian letter. Now, he has some of these from Macedonia traveling down with him. And when he arrives at Corinth, it is hopeful that they will have this collection ready. But from Corinth, he writes another epistle. Who can tell me what that was? Romans. He wrote the book of Romans from Corinth. Interestingly enough, as he writes the book of Romans, he tells those in Rome where he's going and what he's going to do when he gets there. In Romans, the 15th chapter, reading beginning at verse 25, he says, "But now I say, I go unto Jerusalem, ministering unto the saints, for it hath been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints that are at Jerusalem." Let's pause once again. What we see in the text, the instructions were to take up a collection for the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. Again, the reminder was in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, be sure you have this ready. What ready? The collection for the needy among the saints in Jerusalem. When he arrives at Corinth, he writes the book of Romans and he tells them, I'm on my way to Jerusalem with this collection for the needy among the saints at Jerusalem. Now, when he got there, who do you suppose he distributed that to? These messengers representing these churches. What did they do? They distributed it to the saints in Jerusalem who were in need. Now that just follows. If that's not so, then certainly Paul storied about it to them, and that's using a kind word, when he instructed them regarding the taking up of this collection. The recipients of these funds were those who were needy among the saints. Now, regarding churches, establishing some kind of a benevolent society, whatever kind or type it might be, and then that benevolent society or churches being solicited to supply funds for that benevolent society that is designed for the needs of anyone in the community who might have need. Again, we must ask the question, where do we find that in the Scriptures? If we can't find a passage, then we don't have a discussion. Now, before I leave that thought, we've already established that individuals, and here's the distinction in this lesson, that individuals have a tremendous responsibility to ever who you may be able to help. But the church has a special responsibility toward those who are saints. That's correct. That is correct. Yeah, the ultimate recipients, of course, would be the saints, the poor among the saints in Jerusalem. But that's right. The elders of each local church would have the oversight of those who were members of that local church who were in need. That's exactly right. All right? Further comment or question? Okay? I have some questions about the individual in the church. Number one, what is a man's special spiritual condition if he fails to provide for his own? He's denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever. Now you know I'm going to ask you the passage. Where do I read that? 1 Timothy 5 verse 8. Very good. 1 Timothy 5 verse 8 says, but if any provideth not for his own, and specially his own household, he hath denied the faith and worse than an unbeliever. We have that responsibility as individuals to care for our own. May the church do whatever the individual can do. Now explain why one individual Christian is not the same as the church. Can the church do whatever the individual can do? And why?
Well, it just said that a member is supposed to provide for his family, and they can get a job, and start a business, whatever they want to do, but the church can't do that.
All right, all right. All right.
Church is an entity in itself.
That is right.
An individual.
That is right. And the word church. What do we learn about simply the use of the word church? James? I'm sorry. All right. It is a plural noun. Not a plural noun. It is a collective noun. Thank you. It is a collective noun. Point being, a collective noun is similar to what? Herd or flock, it has to do with a collectivity that acts as a unit, an entity in and of itself. So no, an individual and the church is not the same thing. If that be so, then how would those who have widows care for them that the church be not charged? There wouldn't be any sense in even using the word church if an individual activates the church as a whole. Randy, you had a question or a comment?
I was just going to say that the instructions are different for the church and
for individual. That's true. The instructions are different. Number three, what may an individual do that the church cannot do? David, you hit the nail on the head with your answer a while ago.
Own business or work, church.
All right. All right.
You could, but as an individual, we could give money to organizations, to church,
okay.
Start a business.
All right, that's kind of what he was saying. Church not in a business as such, doesn't start a business, and we use the illustration, I think, in the discussion of these things about an individual providing for his family by buying 200 acres of farmland and putting cattle on it and raising cattle and selling calves. He can do that, can't he, to supply the needs of his family? Can the church buy a 200-acre cattle farm? Well, if we can see that, then we see the point that's being established here. Here are things that I can do as an individual that the church not only not obligated to do, but cannot do. And here we have a list of things from 1 Timothy chapter 5. Verse 4, show piety at home and requite their parents. Can the church do that? Church doesn't have parents. This is action that is required of each individual. And we've looked at verse 8, provide for his own, marry and bear children. Verse 14, instructions that were given to the younger widows. If these younger widows marry and bear children, does that indicate the church is activated? Well, no. And relieve one's own widows, that the church be not charged. We've discussed that from verse 16. Lay hands suddenly upon no man. We see in verse 22 as Paul was instructed, or Timothy was instructed by Paul. And we notice in verse 23, Timothy was instructed to drink no longer water, but use a little wine for thy stomach's sake. Is Paul talking to the church, or is he talking to an individual as he writes this to Timothy? Now, it's simple to see these principles. Now, the importance of these principles comes to the application. What must the mission of the church be? Anything that the church does must be worthy of the blood of Christ. In Ephesians chapter 5, we learn that He is the Savior of the body. In Acts chapter 20, in verse 28, He purchased the church with His blood. Does then the church have a responsibility to perform in any way that would come under the umbrella of purchasing the church with the blood of Christ? You see, if we get outside of that, then we can do anything we want to. But these passages limit the church's activity to those things that would come under the scope of the blood of Christ. This is why He died. He didn't die so we can play basketball. He didn't die so we can get together and have a pizza supper. He didn't die so we can go out and play football together. He died because the church became a spiritual body, an entity that we can read about in 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning at verse 5. Another question I want to ask you. Was Jesus pleased when people followed for loaves and fishes? Well, let's open our Bibles. John the 6th chapter. Let's read about it. John the 6th chapter. This passage has always fascinated me. John chapter 6, beginning at verse 1. It says, after these things, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. And a great multitude followed Him because they beheld the signs which He did on them that were sick. Now let's pause right there and let me ask the question, what was it that the multitudes saw? They saw signs. Jesus was healing sick people. Jesus was performing miracles. Who saw it? The multitudes did. And in verse 3, Jesus went up into the mountain, and there He sat with the disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Jesus therefore, lifting up His eyes, and seeing that a great multitude cometh unto Him, saith unto Philip, whence are we to buy bread that these may eat? And this He said to prove them, for He Himself knew what He would do. Philip answered Him, 200 shillings worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one may take a little. One of His disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, saith unto Him, there is a lad here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes. But what are these among so many? Jesus said, make the people sit down. Now there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down in number about 5,000. Now some have told us that when you read the text and it says there were 5,000 men, that you factor in the possibility of women and perhaps children or so forth, and you come up with a number that's a whole lot bigger than just 5,000. But 5,000, let's just stop there. 5,000 to be fed with 5 barley loaves and 2 fishes. What would you consider that to be, Randy, if you had a pail that had five loaves of bread, little loaves of bread and two fish? That'd be about your lunch, wouldn't it? All right. That'd be about one's lunch. Never mind. Depends on who's eating, doesn't it? I heard that. Yeah, well, moving right along. You heard what I said about digging a hole, right? Okay.
Well, I started to be quiet.
Yeah, had to say that. I know. Well, with these five barley loaves and two fishes, Jesus fed the multitudes. And it tells us that 12 baskets of pieces or leftovers were taken up. They wound up with more leftovers than they had food when they started. Now look at verse 14. In verse 14 it says, "When therefore the people saw the sign." Wait a minute now. What people?
The multitude.
What have they already seen? They've seen Jesus heal sick folks. They've seen signs. But it says, "When they saw the sign," which he did, "they said, this is of a truth the prophet that cometh into the world." Now, don't miss that. Jesus came into the world, according to John chapter, 30 and 31. They came into the world, the text tells us, many other signs, therefore did Jesus, chapter 20, did Jesus in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in His name. Jesus performed many signs, but here's one that's recorded in this book, and the evidence caused belief on behalf of this multitude when they saw the sign. This is the prophet that cometh into the world. Now let's read on. It says, "Jesus therefore, perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, withdrew again unto the mountain himself alone." Now let's pick up the reading, if you will, at verse 22. It says, "On the morrow, the multitude that stood on the other side of the sea saw that there was no other boat there save one, and that Jesus entered not with his disciples into the boat, but that his disciples went away alone. Howbeit, there came boats from Tiberias nigh unto the place where they ate the bread after the Lord had given, after the Lord had given thanks. When the multitude therefore saw that Jesus was not there, neither his disciples, they themselves got into the boats and came to Capernaum seeking Jesus." Now just across the Sea of Tiberias or the Sea of Galilee. Now in verse 25 it says, "And when they found him on the other side of the sea, they said unto him, Rabbi, when camest thou hither? Jesus answered them and said, Verily, verily, I say unto you, ye seek me not because ye saw signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Work not for the food which perisheth, but for the food which abideth unto eternal life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you. For him the Father, even God, hath sealed." Now let's pause right there. Why did Jesus say that they were seeking him? They want to eat again. Now ask yourself the question. The previous day they have seen sick folks be healed. They have seen a multitude fed with a little boy's lunch. And now they follow him across the Sea of Galilee, or Tiberias, to a town called Capernaum. And now they want to be fed again. Previously, on the day before, they have acknowledged that this must be the prophet, must be the Christ. Now read on, if you will, in verse 28. "They said therefore unto him, What must we do that we may work the works of God? And Jesus answered and said unto them, This is the work of God, that ye believe on him whom he hath sent. And they said therefore unto him, What then doest thou for a sign, that we may see and believe thee? What workest thou?" Now think about that for just a moment. Let that hit bottom. What have they seen the day before?
Healings
and... Yeah. They want to know, what can we do that we can do the works of God? Yes, they want to know that. Because Jesus has rebuked them forsaking him simply for the loaves and the fishes. And he tells them that they need to do the things that God wants them to do so that they can have eternal life. Verse 27, work not for the food which perisheth, but for the food which abideth unto eternal life. They want to know, well, what can we do? What work can we do to do that? And now they want Jesus to perform some kind of a sign so that they can know who he is. Well, what had he just done the day before? But the point now, here's the day after, and they're seeking him not because they saw signs, but because they ate and were filled. Now, I make that point simply to establish this point. When it comes to the work of the church, Jesus rebuked some of these because they sought him for secular reasons. They saw him as a source of food, free food. And Jesus said, that's not right. You don't seek me because of free food. You seek me because of the word that I teach you. Now, a lot of folks will say, well, you know, we give somebody free food, then we can teach them. What did Jesus do? Did he give them free food just so he could teach them? All right. We find that miracles were being performed, the first part of chapter 6. And then he performed another miracle so that they might know who he is, and that succeeded. They concluded who he is. He didn't feed them just simply so they wouldn't be hungry. The miracles were designed for the very purpose and intent that they might believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. David and then Randy. All right.
I think in Numbers chapter 11, it tells you what happened to them when they complained and they were asking for meat.
Well, that's right.
They had seen miracles. Their forefathers had seen miracles under Moses way back when. This is, in a sense, sort of a repeat of what their forefathers did.
That's right. But even in this very context, they're wanting Jesus to perform a sign that they might know that he is the Christ. He just did the day before many signs. But in this very context, their argument is, verse 31, our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness. As it is written, he gave them bread out of heaven to eat. Jesus therefore said unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, it was not Moses that gave you the bread out of heaven, but my Father giveth you true bread out of heaven. For the bread of God is that which cometh down out of heaven and giveth life unto the world. They said therefore unto him, Lord, evermore give us this bread. Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall not hunger, and he that believeth on me shall never thirst. Now why have they come to him? So they can eat and be filled. Jesus said, no, that's not why I'm here. The miracle that he performed was to establish that he is the Christ. They had perceived that the day before. Now they come to eat and be filled. Jesus rebukes them. Something by far more important than that. They said, well, our fathers fed us. Jesus said, no, sir. It was not Moses. It was God who fed you. Now they had completely missed the point. And they had completely missed the point about the miracles that Jesus had performed. Jesus had not performed a miracle in feeding them just so they would no longer be hungry any more than God gave them manna in the wilderness just simply so they would not be hungry. When God provided for them in the wilderness food, water, what was the purpose of that? Just so they wouldn't be hungry? So they'd be dependent upon Him. They would know who He is. Now, why did Jesus perform the miracles? So they would know who he is. You see, this wasn't a social program that Jesus provided. And so, looking at this text, we learn something about people following simply for loaves and fishes. Yes, if you want people to follow, you can fill up the building by feeding everybody. You can fill up the building by offering all kinds of social activities and programs. You can even cite John chapter 6 as evidence, well, this is what Jesus did. If you do that, beloved, you've perverted the cause of the text. Jesus did not perform miracles to advocate some kind of social program. Jesus performed miracles according to John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, so you might know who He is. Any question or comment? Yes, Roy?
Have you been performing a lot of miracles been performed before that?
Yes, sir.
So it wasn't something really new?
No.
No,
either here and lots after. Keep in mind that John only identifies 6 or 7 miracles. But he makes the comment in verse 30 and 31, many other signs therefore did Jesus in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in His name. I saw a hand or two, John first, Randy second, and then I saw Peggy's, okay? All right. Yes. Well, what was it? Okay. So did he provide a social program for them? No. No, that wasn't the purpose of that miracle either. Yes, they were hungry, just like the children of Israel were hungry in the wilderness. But the miracle was not simply to take away hunger. Yes, it showed compassion. They were hungry, but the miracle was performed to show who He is.
These were not Christians.
These were not Christians in John chapter 6 either. Yeah, that's true. These were not Christians. These were people He was trying to teach. But what was He trying to teach them? Pardon me?
Gospel.
I don't have any idea what you said.
The gospel.
The gospel. All right. That's right. All right. Does that prompt another question in the mind of anybody? Yes, there were a couple of instances where Jesus fed multitudes. You mentioned which text?
Matthew 15.
You can read again in Mark chapter 8, the same incident, feeding of 4,000. Here, the feeding of the 5,000. In both instances, yes, it shows compassion. Yes, they were hungry. But again, what was the purpose of it? To declare who He was. All right, Randy and then Peggy and David.
Just a quick note on the Matthew 15 thing, that the feeding of the 4,000 ends in verse 38, those who eat were 4,000 men besides one of the children, sending away the multitudes, He got to the boat and came to the region of Magadan. And the Pharisees and Sadducees came up testing Him and asked Him to show them a sign from heaven. Happened there too.
Yes.
But the other thing I was going to say was the people were guilty of the same thing. Herod, you know, in Luke 23, when Pilate sent Jesus to Herod, verse 8, Luke 23:8, Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he wanted to see Him for a long time because he'd been hearing about Him and was hoping to see some sign performed by Him. Mm-hmm. They treated Him like a circus animal.
Yes.
You know, spin a ball on your nose. You know, do something to entertain us.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see you do some magic tricks.
Well, when Jesus rebuked these multitudes for following Him simply because He had fed them, there was concern in the mind of Jesus about even the apostles. Will ye also go away? And the apostle Peter declared, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of life. Well, wasn't that what Jesus had declared to the multitudes? You seek Me because you ate bread and loaves. But He said, seek Me for what else? There's something far greater than that. You see. And that's what He was teaching. David?
Peggy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Peggy?
You know, these folks, to me, are a bunch of doubting Thomases. In the sense that, hey, He performs 2 miracles. They watch Him heal sick and feed 5,000.
Well, you see a similar thought in John chapter 9, where Jesus had healed a man who was blind from birth. And the man who was blind from birth was asked 4 times how that was done. And the man who was born blind said, I've told you before. This is a very loose paraphrase. I've told you before. If I tell you again, will you become a believer? Well, no. David?
And you know, this is the same thing that in the story of Lazarus,
the dead. John 12.
Well, both
11 and 12.
Both of them, because the first one, you know, the rich man wanted him to send somebody raised from the dead to teach him. And Moses said, they won't believe him.
No. They've got the word. If they won't accept that, then...
And then the other Lazarus, when he was raised, Jesus raised him from the dead, and then the Pharisees was plotting to kill him and Jesus.
Yes.
So people would believe, because here's Lazarus raised from the dead. They didn't question whether he was raised from the dead or not.
They didn't care.
They didn't care. And that's basically these cases, is they're looking out for another law.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, another thing of his comment, when he did raise Lazarus from the dead, it was to prove who he was, but he felt compassion.
Oh, certainly.
He said Jesus wept.
Yeah, yeah. The aspect of compassion is not in question. It was the purpose for which he did. Chris, I believe, then Bruce.
I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, the result of Jesus performing miracles, there was a lot of public attention was garnered because of that. People flocked after him.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's interesting in Mark chapter 1 how that he was performing miracles and people were thronging to him as well. And you read how that Jesus went away to a lonely place and the disciples went to look for him. And it says in verse 37, they found him. Some respects, the reaction to the miracles got in the way of what Jesus was trying to do. Jesus was trying to teach and to preach folks, and then sometimes he had to go to someplace else to get down to the world of peace, mm-hmm. because people were looking for the physical side of things.
Okay. Bruce? All right. And all of that comes under the umbrella of the blood of Christ, what he died for. Yes.
In the passage we've been looking at in John 6, you kind of see for a split second in verse 14 where they say this truly is the prophet. But yet in 15, you see that they don't even really know what that means. They don't understand that it's spiritual. They want to make him king. You know, disciples make that mistake too. They still don't even understand what he means.
This becomes a common mistake, even among the apostles. In Acts, the first chapter, after Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection, prior to his ascension, even among the apostles, they wanted to know, do you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? The concept of becoming an earthly king seemed to be common, even among the apostles. Roy, and then Dick.
Do we have a minute?
Yeah. Well, we have a minute.
We have 20 seconds.
We have 20 seconds. Yes.
Well, I'm pretty sure you fed them because they were ready to pass out, don't you think?
Well.
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 The effect of a miracle is great.
Yeah.
And the whole, we know that the higher plane is the belief that he is the bread and man is not the bread alone, and all those great principles.
Yeah.
But the flat, simple fact is they were really hungry and had compassion. I think it's just immediate motivation. What I read is that he wanted to feed them.
Yeah. 5, it says that Jesus says to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these may eat? This he was saying to test him, for he himself knew what he was intending to do. So he was planning to do a miracle.
I'm talking about the 4,000.
Oh.
6,
the other one?
Well, it is true. But again, the words of John come ringing. Many other signs did Jesus in the presence of the disciples. Why were the signs recorded for us? Why were the signs recorded? That's right. So that we can believe. What was the purpose of them then? So that they would believe. That's right. It wasn't just to relieve physical hunger.
But as an incidental point there.
Well, that's true. He had compassion on the multitudes. Yeah. Now, that's not in dispute. But what is in dispute is the purpose for which he performed the miracle. It wasn't just so they wouldn't be hungry.
It's like Lazarus.
you know, when he did raise Lazarus, he could have raised him a lot sooner.
Oh, yeah.
He did, but he wanted to raise him and show him no doubt that he had power over death.
That's right. All right. Very good comment.
We must be aware today, the same situation as the end of the age. People get the wrong things they're interested in doing. And that's what they see, the food, they see the domination of music, all the things that go with it. And we need to be aware.